Kia ora koutou. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, everybody. It's my privilege to be here tonight as your MC. My name is Greg Morgan, and I will be trying to keep us in order. So good luck to me, is what I can say. What we would like to do is to have a little roll call so that we know who is in the room tonight. So I'll come around with a mic. And I see that some food is already being delivered. Now, it's always a problem at a conference dinner if people are a bit embarrassed as to whether they can just take a little bit of that food and have a little taste before others are eating. They feel uncomfortable. And, you know, in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we do bless food. So let me just say a little blessing that will recognize that food strengthens our bodies, nourishes our spirits, and that we are grateful for the bread of life. And so we'll say those words. And then if you feel the need to have a little something to eat, you can do so with a clear conscience. And so, friends, let's just take in these words. Whakapāinga ēnei kai, hei oranga mō o mātou tinana. Whangaia hoki o mātou wairua. Amene. Amene. Right, I'm going to put on a mic and I'm going to gallop around very fast and you're going to say very quickly, who is in the room?
Good evening. I'm Judy Dixon from the United States.
Doug Wakefield, United States.
Maria Stevens, New Zealand.
Tom Schneckenberg, and I'm going to be speaking after the main.
Good evening, everyone. Mary Schneckenberg from New Zealand.
Kia ora koutou. Clive Lansing from New Zealand.
Willow Free, United States.
Anne Lancaster, United States.
Peter Cracknell, Australia.
Josie Howes, Australia.
Good evening, Bill Jolly from Australia.
Greg Stilson, United States.
Thank you. Jodie Martiri from Australia.
Another Jodie from Australia.
Leanne Holloway from Australia.
Excellent, very good. Now table three.
Matthew Horspool, United Kingdom.
Chantal Griffiths, New Zealand.
Talofa, Nicola McDowell, New Zealand.
Garth Humphreys, Australia.
Geordie Howell, Australia.
Talofa, Heliopolisi from Samoa.
Tino Tumapu from Samoa.
Christo de Klerk, South Africa, good evening.
Okay, table four.
Scott Erickson, Australia.
Kia ora, New Zealand. Chaveli Nechituni from South Africa.
Good evening, Nancy Nechituni from South Africa.
Kia ora, Tefano, Paul Brown, New Zealand.
Martin Abel Williamson, Will Blond Union, New Zealand.
Talo Falava Lepa Yaman Manulafia, Ari Hazelman from Samoa.
Lena Coleman, New Zealand.
Ivan Argote from Spain.
Laura Lee from Christchurch, New Zealand.
Okay, table five, here you go.
James Bowden, UK.
Dang Wai Phuc from Vietnam.
Dang An Chuc from Vietnam.
My name is Tuấn from Vietnam.
Tamara Rory, United States.
Emily Rory, United States.
Daphne Hitchcock, Canada.
Jen Golden, Canada, bonsoir.
Thank you very much. And table six, here we go.
Stephen D'Andrea, United States.
Francis Marion D'Andrea, United States.
Jennifer Dunham, United States.
Callie Brusegard, United States.
Kia ora koutou, Amanda Goff, New Zealand.
Samuel Fuchs, United States.
Charlotte Fabe, United States.
Tamara O'Callaghan, United States.
Lindsay Nutter, Canada.
Very good. Now, did I miss anybody out? Goodness me, I'm improving. Getting a lot better. Let me just run through the menu for you. I know that people who have special dietary requirements have had the chance to order their food. So if that isn't you and you have a special requirement, please speak to one of the waiting staff. Otherwise, I will run through the menu. And here it is. Entree, slow-cooked pork belly with crackling crumb, apple aioli and cauliflower and bacon croquettes. DFO. That means duty-free only. Main course, New Zealand Canterbury grilled lamb rump, mashed kumara, steamed broccolini, roast parsnip and potato with cider jus. GFO. I don't know, make it up. And DFO, so gluten-free, of course. And dessert, pavlova. Now, who's Australian in the room? Hands up. Okay, if you want it, take it. The pavlova's yours. You made it. It's fine. We don't care. Pavlova with seasonal fruit and passion fruit glaze, which is also gluten-free. So that's the meal choice. So we'll have our speaker after the main. Just before I leave you in peace, I've been asked to say that behind the lectern, there is a stand of flags. So I don't know whether you've been told about the flags. Let's see the countries that are here. Aotearoa, New Zealand. Very discreet and subtle. We're famous for that. Australia. Yeah. I've never heard Australians be so discreet and subtle. They're learning it. Canada. Wait, there we go. Ireland. Not here. Nepal. South Africa. UK. The United Kingdom. And, of course, the United States of America. Yes. So there we go. All righty. Enjoy your food so far, and then I will come back and talk to you in a little while. Oh, yes, in Spain, but I don't think there's a flag. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, a few people are still eating. Please keep eating. Don't let me stop you. And just a little click-clack of cutlery on the plates will be just fine, so don't feel self-conscious. Very soon we'll be listening to our guest speaker, who will be very entertaining, I know. And then we will have some other little speeches after that, following which there will be the dessert, which is pavlova. And so for people who do not come from New Zealand or Australia, I should just explain to you that there is a dispute as to the origin of pavlova. The Australians claim it, the New Zealanders defend it. I say give it to them. There are more important battles. As long as we can eat it, who cares who created it? What was that, Martin? Yeah, there are lots of friendly rivalries between our countries with things being claimed. So there we go. Is there anything anybody would like to say about today? Just as people are finishing their meals, is there anything that you would quickly like to say about today? The top table doesn't know that I'm asking you this. They're now sitting there nervously. Is there anything you'd like to say? Oh. Anybody, put your hand up if there's something you'd like to say. Last time Martin spoke, a dog barked. We all know that dogs bark a lot. Very good. All right, in a few moments, I'll introduce our guest speaker. Just chat at the tables in the meantime. Thank you. Very good. Maybe we would like to give a round of applause to Banzat and ICEB for the dinner this evening. A round of thanks. Excellent. So that's the practice for applauding, because you'll need to applaud when you listen to Tom Schnackenberg. So Tom is OBE, or that's Order of the British Empire, and I think, Tom, you've also got the Medal of the Order of Australia, is that right? Yes. So Tom is an entertaining speaker always, and he has come into the room this evening with a model. Now, I want you all just to imagine what that could possibly mean. That Tom Schnackenberg would enter a room with a model. So I leave you with that thought, and we welcome Tom to the microphone. Thank you, Tom. Do you want the handheld or the lectern?
I'm going to walk around and take that, but otherwise...
Yeah, you can use either.
Okay. Just put it down.
It's there when you want it. There when you want it. There you go.
Excellent.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Greg, and good evening, everybody. The main reason I'm here is not because of my expertise in anything, but because I'm Mary's brother, and she calls me up and said, oh, come and give a talk. But the model that we got there was something that I gave Mary for her birthday, a significant birthday a few years ago, which occurred about the time we were having a challenge in New Zealand, and she had trouble visualising these America's Cup class yachts on their foils. So we thought, well, the only way to visualise is actually have something you can feel. And so we arranged to do a 3D print of this boat, standard sort of boat called the AC-75. And that's what's sitting here. And, of course, you can go and feel it and see how the wings come out each side and the rudders are foil. And the whole thing is basically flying in the air when it's racing on these foils. And I've been involved in the America's Cup from 1977 till 2013, about 36 years, working for different teams, four Australian teams, four Kiwi teams, and then the Americans once, way back in 77, Italians, the Swiss, and the Swedes. And so I know everything that I experienced. And then, of course, I became a bit of a historian, because we got involved, two of the challenges I was involved what they call the deed of gift, where people don't agree, so you go to the court. And this deed of gift is like the Constitution. For the America's Cup was written by these characters who gave the trophy to the New York Yacht Club, and the deed of giving said, this is the rules for the contest we're going to have. And it's a little bit like the Constitution. It was written in about 1860 and then revised in 1870. And so things were very different in terms of the way the world was organized then, just the way the US was different in the 1700s when the Constitution was written. But it still has a lot of weight when they decide how things are going to go on. So I'm happy to, I'm not going to tell you very much more about my individual things until people ask me questions, and I'm happy to talk about any of the challenges that I was in, and also the stories I know from the earlier ones, because when I was working with these chaps, I found myself reading the history of the Cup just to see what actually happened in 1880 and what happened in the year 1935 and what happened when we were racing. But I got fascinated by just listening to the Braille speeches, some of the people talking over the last few days, and I realised how high-tech this Braille has become. It started out, you know, the six dots, and it's still the six dots, but what you do with it is amazing, and it made me realise how high-tech this audience is. And so I thought, let's have a little bit of fun. And one of the things I thought I might do is to maybe try to envisage what might come next. And so I got a hold of, I downloaded the ChatGPT app on my phone. And I made a couple of phone calls, and guys were quite responsive. So I thought for a little bit of fun, I could do the same thing. I could have my phone going, and I can call, and then maybe you can hear Mr. Chat himself, and see if I can persuade him to say nice things to the audience. And so you can visualize how this group might start using artificial intelligence as you go forward the next few years. I mean, plenty of things that can go wrong, and maybe even right tonight, nothing might work if my internet signal's not very good. But long term, it's got enormous potential, and I think maybe particularly for blind people, because blind people are automatically verbal, because they have to be in their life, and so it's one of the first things that I noticed Mary could do. She could talk intelligently from when she was about 1 year old. And so I'll have a little bit of fun and see if this works. And then I can, then people have got probably got different things to talk about and ask about. This says connecting. And then it says, I'm going to hold it close to the microphone, listening. So, hello, my name is Tom, and I'm talking to a large group of people who are dining here in Auckland, and they're all interested in Braille, but also interested in ChatGPT.
Hi, Tom, and everyone dining in Auckland. It's great to hear that you're interested in both Braille and ChatGPT. If you have any questions about Braille, technology, or anything else, feel free to ask.
Thank you very much. I do have questions, and it could go on and on, but the main reason for this talk this evening is just so that the audience can get their own ideas, and they'll have questions, no doubt, and you may well wind up getting lots of calls tomorrow.
That sounds wonderful. I'm here to help with any questions you or the audience might have. Feel free to ask anything, and I'll do my best to provide useful information. What's the first question on your mind?
First question on my mind is, if we had a small group of experts having a meeting, let's say three or four, would it make sense to invite you to come to the meeting as number five, and would that be something you're used to doing?
While I can't physically attend meetings, I can certainly participate virtually. I can provide information, answer questions, and offer insights in real time, just like a fifth member. Many groups find it useful to have me assist during their discussions. Do you have a specific topic in mind for the meeting?
No, I'm not an expert in Braille, but there might be, I can look around the room and there's 50 odd people here, and all 50 have probably got something on their mind, but that's not necessarily something we would do this evening. I just started this just so people could see how good you were at responding, and I think you've done very well.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to hear that. It's great to be part of your evening. If anyone has a question now or in the future, I'm here to help.
Okay, thank
you. Enjoy your evening, everyone.
Okay, thanks very much. Good evening, and I'll start answering questions about other things. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome, Tom. Have a great evening, and feel free to reach out anytime.
Okay. So it does work, and the other thing is, of course, is the transcript of that entire conversation, what he thought I said and what he said. Bang, so you've automatically got minutes. And he wasn't scared at the thought of, you know, being part of a group of four or five people. And obviously, he'd have to get to know all of them. They'd have their own name. And they could ask his opinion on anything. Is it going to be fine tomorrow? Or what should we do? And it'd be interesting to see. I've asked ChatGPT technical questions in the past. One I asked was about particular helicopter maneuver. And I learned that he really knew an awful lot, but he didn't have any real understanding in this particular situation. And so you may find that sort of thing happens. But then, of course, you can teach them. And I remember reading a story written by a guy who's a negotiator. And he said he asked ChatGPT, if you were coaching Zelensky, you know, and he was going into negotiations with Putin, what would you tell him? And so the guy came, ChatGPT gave him this answer. And then he said, okay. And he said, now, if you were coaching Putin, what would you tell him? And so ChatGPT came up with another answer. And then he said, okay, well, now that we know that you've told Putin this, would you change what you're telling Zelensky? And so he came up with a third answer. And the guy that wrote was a professional, professor at Harvard or something like that, and he does this for a living, advising governments, mainly the US government probably. And he was very impressed. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there, and I'm pleased that he was awake when we called and was able to answer. And he also had, I've always found, a really good attitude, and that's one of the key things. So now I'm just happy to, if anybody's got any questions about the cup, then sing out, Greg's got a microphone. You can ask me anything about anything that I've been involved with, and also what I've heard about other ones, and any predictions I might make.
What was it like being part of the winning New Zealand team and the first New Zealand America's Cup winning team in 1995, and just the way that the country responded to you? What was that like?
It was amazing, because we were there. We left here without much of... People didn't think that we had a very fast boat, because a few people had said, oh, no, this is not good. And the journalists in the States all thought that, you know, there was a couple of going between the defender and maybe Chris Dixon and the French and the Australians, and we didn't feature in that. And then when we started winning races, everything changed. And in fact, the fact that we had they had low expectations of us was a big factor, because people weren't looking at us. And so what happened, of course, is that people in New Zealand just started calling us up and we said, my golly, it's really big news back home. And that really inspired the team. Yes?
Oh, hang on, Judy. I'll bring
the mic.
Judy? I'll bring the mic.
I think I recall that you were a tactician. Can you tell us what a tactician does?
A tactician tries to keep the helmsman, his brain, you know, corrects, and actually gives him advice of what to do. And actually, I wasn't the tactician, I was the navigator. So my job is to tell them where we are and where I think we should be going. And a classic one, of course, was deciding when we should tack for the mark at the end. You know, the mark was a long way away, so using compasses. We knew where it was in the computer, but we couldn't see it quite often when we were tacking for it. So I would have all this mathematics saying, well, you know, the wind is doing this and that, and about now would be when we should go. And it was the same thing. I remember going downwind. The tactician was Brad Butterworth. And he would be the one that would actually say, let's go now. And then Russell, who was the skipper and the helmsman, would then go. And you could tell Russell would be, of course, making up his own mind while all of this was happening. And it was a classic, because we would come on down and Brad would say, I think we let's jibe now. And if Russell thought it was a bit early, he would say, is everybody ready? And then, are you ready? Jeremy, you're ready? Okay, getting standby to jibe. And about 10 seconds would go by, and then he'd say, okay, ready to jibe, we're jibing now. But on the other hand, if he thought we were late, he'd just start turning the boat the instant that Brad said jibing. And then he'd start giving other instructions like, oh, we might have to use the jib, you know, because we've gone too far. And so that's what it's like being it's just a group of people having fun, but trying to win a yacht race. And my job was to figure out where we were. And the best time I had, in a way, was one day was foggy. And it was so foggy that only one race took off, and it was us and the other guys. And we couldn't see anything, but I had everything in my GPS. I knew where the marks were meant to be, and it turned out they were in the right place. GPS worked. So I would say, Mark should be a little bit to the left and should start showing up soon, you know. About 60 metres away was about our visibility, and there it would be. and we'd go around the mark and we finished the race and we won it. And in that same day, a big aircraft carrier came through and nearly ran across the starting line because their visibility wasn't that great. And they stopped and realized there were a whole bunch of boats sitting there, and they were standing on the deck, flight deck of this aircraft carrier looking at these. And eventually they backed off. And that night, of course, I was having nightmares. I was thinking, what if the GPS had gone down on the boat? What would I have done? All I would have known is that America was to the east. That was about the limit of my knowledge without GPS. So I went out and bought my own spare GPS and carried it with me each day just in case the instruments on the yacht went down.
Any more questions? Questions, anybody? I've got the mic here. Questions?
There's one here.
Over here. Mr. Jolly. Hang on. Here we go. Here, Bill.
Thank you. Great to have you with us, Tom. I'll try and distill my 37 questions down to a reasonable number. So a sort of a light-hearted question first is, thinking back to Ben Lexon, and you might want to briefly talk about what his contribution was. Thinking about Ben Lexon and yourself, when you're thinking about design, do you think that the artificial intelligence of today would be a lot more helpful than it was back when, say, Ben was working 40 years ago? The second question is that yesterday when we were at the Maritime Museum, it was talked about that asymmetry, and I mean, I'm a mathematician, so I understand the background to that, asymmetry in the boat was important because you have to take into account a number of factors, including wind direction and current, that can sometimes be overlooked. So I wonder if you can explain what that might mean. And thirdly, and this is sort of a more serious question. When a few years ago I went for a trip down the Yangtze River in China on one of these boats, so it was a fairly narrow upright boat, and a week later, and it was a lovely trip, but a week later the same sort of boat was going down the Yangtze River and it tipped over and went under in about 5 minutes. There was a time when one of the America's Cup boats, and I can't remember the name of it, so I won't try to say what it was, tipped over, and fortunately no one was lost. But it all happened so quickly. I wonder if you can explain to us as blind people what sort of happened with that and why the incident would have happened sort of so rapidly. Thank you.
Well, there are three questions and I've forgotten most of them, but I can answer another question. I'll start with the asymmetry because it's quite fun, and I remember it was a big deal in San Diego because it was consistent. And the reason was that we had a current coming down the coast about a knot. It's quite a lot because the boats are only going 7 or 8 knots, and the wind was coming from the west. So, and they tried to set the mark upwind, so you went upwind and downwind, but you couldn't do it there. You spent more time kind of going into the current on both upwind and downwind, so the legs were very biased, and it would have been, and if you're spending two-thirds of the time on port tack, which we were, or port jibe, and only one-third of the time on starboard, well, you say, well, let's just get the boat a wee bit faster on port and a wee bit slower on starboard, and that'll will be faster around the track. Now, I don't think anybody wanted to make the hulls asymmetric because you weren't always going to be racing in San Diego, so the idea was to make the boats useful anywhere in the world. But you could do that with the rig, and you could actually make it so that the rig was a little bit more powerful on one tack than the other. Jumping to Ben Lexon, he and I, we didn't see all that much of each other because he was worried about the hull when I was learning about sails. And so I was in New Zealand trying to figure out how to design sails, and he was in Holland, you know, running the boat and the tank test. But of course, whenever we talked, it was really, really useful. And so we just respected what he had done, and we were pretty impressed, and he was always thinking of what could go better. And he'd been a radical thinker right from the very beginning. You know, for example, he put wings on the bottom of the keels on an 18-footer in Sydney about 15, 20 years before we put them on Australia too. And so they were in the back of his mind as being something useful. And then actually things that can go wrong on boats, there's plenty. It happened because the boats, we tend to make them very close to their safety limits, you know. Airplanes, for example, are made really safe. Well, they try to make them safe. And whereas yachts, Ben would say, well, if the mast hasn't fallen down, you made it too strong. And so that was his, you know, his basic thing. Let's make it as light as we can, because obviously these boats lean over in the wind, and if the boat's got a lower center of gravity, because it's got a lighter mast and then maybe a heavier keel, then it's going to be a bit more powerful. And so we tended to be right at the breaking limits, and that's why, for example, in the Cup in Newport, we had seven races, and a couple of them we were sort of broken, and not seriously, but and one of them, Dennis, was in trouble because he broke a jumper strut, and so their boat was asymmetric in the wrong way. So just really spent a lot of time on the wrong tack. And so a boat will tip over if something breaks, and also a combination of a little bit of weakness, and then the wind, of course, can be gusty, and you can get an unexpected one or an unexpected wave. So it's quite common for a boat to tip over because, again, they're almost on the edge of being manageable or not manageable. And hopefully it's only occasionally that we actually lose a life. You know, when I say maybe once every 10 or 20 years, but there's always that risk. Something breaks, a person gets hit on the head by a block flying through the air, and it's just the same as a bullet. Or in our case on Artemis, we tipped over one day, and the boat was really big, 50 feet wide, 70 feet long, and one of the crew wasn't hanging on tight when the boat tipped over, and he just wound up falling gently through the air and then hit his head on the strut, and that killed him. So we lost him and Bart Simpson in 2013. So there's always that risk, but we tend to, because we're trying to win a yacht race, we tend to play closer to the edge than you would do in a lot of other industries.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Oh, Clive, yep. Okay.
Yeah, Tom, I thought I'd change tack a bit.
That's a terrible pun. Yeah.
Some of us in the room are interested in 3D printing, so maybe just tell us a bit about how you constructed that model.
The model is made in, a small tank full of liquid. And I don't know, Clive, you probably know more about 3D printing than I do, but basically a computer program tells the machine what you want in way of shape, and then basically the machine's firing little laser beams into the water and creating, you know, solidify as it goes and create this solid piece of work, which is the hull shape. Okay, Clive's going to say no, that's not right.
I guess I'm interested more in how you sourced the data to create the model.
Oh, okay.
I think we know about 3D printing, but the process of the actual model that we have.
Well, basically, it's, if you like, a stock model produced and published by Team New Zealand to show the world what these boats were going to be like. So it wasn't a design in the sense that it had been optimised. And so right now, for example, we've got five Challengers and the Defender. They've all got slightly different shaped hulls. And so, but Team New Zealand published this way back in about 2018, said we're going to do a boat that looks like this. So you can get that model on the internet. And so a guy called Ben Goodwin, who's an engineer and a farmer and a yachtie, he basically got it off the internet, and he wrote the software to come up with the files that the printer needed. And the same thing with the foils, they were there also produced by, if you like, Team New Zealand to show what a foil might look like. And so this model's got two foils at different angles just to show what might happen. But in real life, when the boat's sailing, normally one foil's right down in the water and the boat's living on that, and the other foil's up in the air. And there's actually a rule to stop you from having both foils in the water for longer than about, I think, 20 seconds or during a manoeuvre. And the reason they make that rule is that if you had two foils in the water, then what you would do is you'd put one foil on the downwind side, lifting you up, and the other foil on the upwind side would be pulling you down, which would obviously increase your power because the couple between those two would increase the righting moment of the boat, but also would increase all the loads and increase the risk. So rather than everybody getting into a design like that, in the rule, as you go into a manoeuvre like a tack that Clive talked about, or a jibe, when you're going down, when you put the both foils down, the second foil goes down. Now you've got two foils in the water, the boat's slowing down. It's quite symmetric. Each foil is changing its angles in a small way as you manoeuvre. Then you come out onto the new heading, and off you go, and within 20 seconds you have to lift that spare foil out of the water and put it up in the air, and that's why it happens that way.
Should we tell people where the model is? So as you go to walk out the door, I'll just turn the mic, I'll just move the mic for a minute.
So I'm standing here, facing the door. Now I'm at the wall, at the front of the wall, I'm facing the model. Now I'm tapping the model.
I'm not sure I'm supposed to be tapping the model, but I'm tapping the model. So that's where it is if you want to have a look.
And I'll go and stand by the model after we... act as a sort of a show-off and show people.
So I'm told that it's where the demonstration table was today, which would have been a much simpler instruction. And Tom's going to be there to make sure that people are not tapping the model. Is that right, Tom?
Say that again.
You're going to be there to make sure people aren't drumming.
Oh, that's right. People can touch the model and feel it. That's the whole idea of it. Just to allow somebody who's visually impaired to actually visualise this yacht, because photographs don't, really can't be seen. And so, whereas the model, physically, suddenly you can imagine it, and then after that you can see the whole thing. Ha-ha, Judy.
Yes.
Oh, you've got a dog, you can give me a dog.
I do. Yeah. You want a dog? Yeah. Yeah. She's for sale.
Yeah, okay. Here we go, here's the microphone.
Thank you so much, Tom. Actually, Tom, you do have a connection with Braille. In the United States, we have a magazine called the New York Times Large Type Weekly, and they select the best articles from the New York Times to publish in large print, and then the National Library Service puts that in Braille. And sometime, I don't know, Mary, if you remember what year it was, but in the late 80s, early 90s, I'm browsing through my New York Times Large Type Weekly, and I see the name Tom Schnackenberg. And I said, I know who that is. And so I immediately mailed it to Mary so she would see her brother's name in Braille in the New York Times. I mean, that's really, I've never been in the New York Times. I think that's absolutely fabulous. So thank you, Tom. This is so interesting to hear about something other than Braille for a minute. We have a little bag of goodies. It's a goodie bag. Yes. So thank you from Banzat and ICEB, and it has been absolutely wonderful having you here. Thank you so much.
And thank you for inviting me, and I'll have a glass of wine now while everybody else is having dessert, and then I'll be standing by the model and can explain a bit more to those who are interested in it.
So we're going to have dessert now, and then Judy has something else to say, so Judy will come back and do that after the dessert. And then by that time, the glass of wine will have worn off for Tom, and he will be in a position to show people the model. Is that right? Perfect. So we'll get ready for the dessert. Thank you. Another round of applause.
Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen. Very good. How was dessert? Do you want to enter the debate of who owns the pavlova, really? Do you care? No. Very good. So now it's time to listen again to President Judy. So let's give her a round of applause. There we go. Lectern is yours.
I have decided I'm going to go up and down New Zealand trying pavlova everywhere I go, and then I'm going to write an article about what was the best. I like it. It's spectacular. Well, it's difficult to put on a conference like this, and this one has been truly spectacular because of the great help we've had in doing it. I have been on the phone with Mary and Maria at least once a week for the last 6 months. I made lists and, okay, Mary, I have 6 things to ask you about. And she says, well, I have 14 things to ask you about. You know. So we have had many, many conversations. You know, just like no Braille detail is too small, well, no conference organization detail is too small either. So I have some gift for Mary and Maria. Maria? Maria, if you could come up, please. And it's one of these nice 3D printed globes, and it's got a magnet, and it sits on its little magnet and stays there. Sorry? And it's got Braille, and this one says, Braille keeps me in touch with the world. She's proofreading it, you know. Here's a bag that it goes in. But it could roll off the top. Do you want to speak at all? No, you didn't want to. Okay. You don't have to. Okay. All right. Thank you, Maria. Mary. I'm afraid one of these globes is going to fall off and roll away. Ooh. What happened? What happened?
Little guide dog intervention.
Oh. Okay.
Okay.
So Mary, here is a 3D printed globe on its magnet, on its base.
Yes.
And it says, ICEB, Braille keeps me in touch with the world. Okay, there's the, yep.
Okay, thank you very much, Judy. The world of tactile graphics has changed incredibly. In fact, I was telling someone a story this morning about in 1961, my family gave me the Chambers Encyclopedia for Children, and it was Braille by the Scottish Braille Press. And about the same time I discovered cricket on the radio, and so Americans, that is actually a sport. But anyway, I became really interested, and I looked up the page and a half of Braille for cricket, and there were two really important things about the story. The first part of the story was that as you read through, you read a page and a half's worth of rules, and then you read, the diagram of the cricket pitch is not included. If you know anything about cricket at all, you will know that it's kind of important to know where all the catchers are standing around the field. And you want to be able to hit the ball to where the catchers aren't. That's part of the game of being a Donald Bradman, I think. Anyway, But the other part of the story that's quite important is how tactile graphics have changed in my lifetime. When I was an 11-year-old, it was the first time I saw a map of New Zealand. And I still think it's incredibly untidy because south is meant to be south of north. No, if you fly from Auckland to Wellington, the pilot's likely to tell you, if you look out the left window, you'll see this, which is the bottom of the North Island. And if you look out the other window, you'll see this, which is the top of the South Island. But south is meant to be south of north, not according to New Zealand geography. This is a lovely gift, and I really appreciate it. ICEB, Braille keeps me in touch with the world, and trying to help the sighted community understand that Braille equals print is a bit of a drama. And then if you turn the globe around in your hand carefully, eventually you'll get to the bit that has NZ on it, and there's AU as well. So those of you who are troubled about Pavlova, remember we also argue about a horse called Farlap. And then there's a musician called Julian Lee, and how long did he spend time in Australia compared with New Zealand? But at least he was born here, and you know that. So thank you so much. Thank you. And one other detail. Yes, Tom's my big brother. And as we all know, family and teachers are incredibly important. In the mid-1960s, we had one or two paid transcribers in New Zealand, but we also had amazing volunteer transcribers. And so Tom helped the volunteer transcriber who was brailing my maths for grade 8 and 9 at high school to get me through school certificate. And so Tom was forever explaining it. And for the Americans in the room, until from 1964 until 2008, the maths code we used was Nemeth. Yes, you can cheer as much as you like. But try explaining to sighted people why there's more than one Braille symbol for the plus sign. And, you know, there's only one print symbol. So there's a lot of work for Braille to do. But thank you very much, Judy. This is absolutely wonderful. And, yeah, that's really amazing. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know, Mary and I have been close personal friends since the 80s, for almost 40 years. We've visited one another's homes. This is my 8th trip to New Zealand, and all of them have been to visit Mary. And we've been together in Germany and Canada and all over the US and the UK and lots of other places. So, Mary, thank you very, very much. I've enjoyed your friendship enormously. Thank you. All right, we also have to thank. I want to thank tonight's MC, Greg Morgan. We have a goodie bag for you.
Oh, you do.
Yes.
Very kind.
There. Maria put together these fabulous goodie bags with, I know there's a big chocolate bar in there. You know. Yes. All right, thank you very much. This concludes this evening's event. Oh, I guess Greg's going to say bye. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Round of applause for everybody. Remember that Tom is going to be standing beside the model to help you have a good look at it. And I've just been thinking that, in fact, I have known Mary since the 1970s. When Mary first showed me some Braille. In fact, my very first encounter with Mary, a story I've told before, was when I met her at a taxi and she said, "It's much easier if I take your elbow and you call me Mary." instead of Miss Schneckenberg. So it was a very special thing. The other thing that I take away from tonight, or I take a couple of things away. One, obviously Braille is in great shape with such strong champions as you all are. So I take that away. It's been great to be here. And the second thing is, of course, Tom's lesson from Mr. ChatGPT, that you can know a lot but understand nothing. That's just like perfection for me. That's wonderful. So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. And travel safely when you get to go home. Thank you.